Patrick.
I said good morning in my heart.
All right.
Anthony, I know you well enough to believe you.
All right. I want to take a poll, soft poll, this morning. So we can kind of go as far into this as we wish to. You choose. But what I'd love to hear from a variety of us about this morning is, we could kind of come at this a few different ways. So we're talking about the thanks part of help, thanks, wow, these three essential prayers this morning. And I mean, I'm listening to what comes out of the shared heart of the community this morning in our community time, and I'm thinking, I can't decide if talking about thanks in the context of the things we're carrying together now is irony or hope or some rich stew of all of these things, you know. And I think as we kind of unfold this, we'll see that there's an important intersection, but it doesn't always feel that way coming in. So maybe what might help us a little bit is to think about one of kind of two or three ways into this idea. Think about when you are most likely to feel thankful. What sort of circumstances tend to make you feel the most thankful? Or if it's a time or a place or a framework. Here is when I usually feel the most thankful. Or these are the sorts of things that tend to stir that up in me. Or if you can think of a particular moment in your life where it just kind of, that's what kind of bubbled out. I feel so thankful right now. And you can remember it. So it has particularity. So story time. Anybody? What do you got? I didn't prepare anything. So if you guys don't come up with something, we're done. Like, we're just going to eat treats and go home. No, Terry, go ahead. No, I did. I can't even deny it.
I get called Terry a lot, and Tim gets called
Kim. I'm Bill. What do you have for us, Terry?
I'm the most thankful when in situations of near misses, where I just about die. We're driving along, and like a near accident, or that's the most thankful, I feel like, a near accident. I always come away feeling like my sinuses are completely clear, and I am so thankful. Not just for the sinuses, but for avoiding a catastrophe.
Can I just suggest that if you find yourself seeking out life-threatening situations when your sinuses are plugged, it's time to talk to somebody about this. Okay, yeah, near misses for sure. Dave? Well, you're Dave, right? Sorry. Okay.
There's not too many of us here today, but in the context of what was being prayed today and some of the things like, that are really tough, I'm thankful for my family because in life, you run into tough times, tough situations. And for me, what's been very helpful to get me through it is the family that God has given me. And if I had any advice to give, it would be for us to nurture those relationships with our family. Because sometimes we have fallings out with our family members, but it's well worth it to take the time and the effort, the prayer, to nurture those relationships. Because when stuff happens in life, it's wonderful to have them there to support us. So that's what I'm thankful for.
Ray?
This actually came up at a session I attended this morning. I go to a church and get a Bible study. It had to do with deficiencies or poverty. And we have an exercise for next week as to where our poverty intersects with somebody else's poverty. Got me thinking. There's a guy in my block who's had spinal bifida. He's never walked. I'm thankful I have feet. And I have a cousin who is deaf. And he's never heard from the sign. He's never heard Taylor Swift either.
That was a pretty good yin and yang.
Same thing with, I'm thankful I have my ears.
Yeah.
thankful when a child is born. I'm thankful when a seizure starts. I'm thankful when I walk all alone out in nature. It's really quiet.
Awesome. All awesome and challenging things, aren't they? Anybody else?
I'm always thankful that I have choices.
I'm thankful for the delusion of choices. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's out of control. I saw your hand first.
I think it was last week. There was a moment, I work with students, and there was a moment where I just felt known by this student, and I think I feel a really deep-seated gratitude and thankfulness when I feel known. And it wasn't anything profound, but like she just looked at me, she's like, you know, Donovan, there are certain soul languages, and your soul language is music. And I was just like, wow. Yeah, like you know me, or you. She knew me in that moment,
yeah.
And so I feel when I have a deep human connection or feel known by someone, I'm really grateful.
Yeah, sort of on my mom's thing, just that we have choices, and that usually when we're complaining, they're very like, these first world problems, and that just specifically that there's so many people. Emotional. They're supporting us, so Graham can do his dream, and I can still go to work, you know? So we're both kind of doing our dreams right now. It's a really nice thing, so I can't wait to love people watching him, you know?
Yeah. And we don't hand our kids to just anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
It's awesome. Bet we could keep going. Maybe we should. It'd be like a free week for me, because I could just come back and talk about thanks. Well, you guys, thank you. That's I was kind of when I thought about this idea, I thought, I wonder if it's a smart thing to listen to what might come, because who knows what that'll be, and see if there's common denominators. And I decided about halfway through that I wasn't going to do that this morning. Although I think there are some common denominators. But one of the things, in reflecting on thanks this week, one of the things that struck me is how the act of being thankful needs an object. It's kind of a meaningless exercise in some ways to be thankful without direction. Not meaningless might be too strong. Certainly less meaningful, I think, without direction. So I've been doing this. I've been doing this, what I think is a relatively innocent social experiment, for the last while. We'll see. I've decided that even though there seems to be some social confusion about the act, I am going to make it my habit to open doors for people. Not just women. I use that coupling of words advisedly, but because part of the social confusion is around our gender roles, and there's historic reasons for that. Just whoever's coming behind me to the same door. I'm going to hold the door for them. And it's been really interesting. I don't tell the participants they're participating. It's a blind experience. You've just been doored. Like, what do you even say to somebody, you know? I'm just doing it. I'm not making a big deal out of it. This is my thing. But it's been fascinating and mostly delightful. And it's been fascinating because the experiences have been quite varied. It's been delightful because most of them have included somebody saying thanks to me, which is not why I'm doing it. I'm not because I'm walking out the door going, I feel like my thanks tank's kind of empty. I'm going to hold some doors and see if I can get perfect strangers to fill me back up. But people do say thanks when you do something nice for them, most of the time. Sometimes it's pretty subtle. Sometimes the thanks is pretty subtle. It's just this little nod, it's this little body posture thing that happens. It just says, I appreciate that. Sometimes it's the reciprocal nature of, you know, lots of our entryways in this climate are airlocks, and there's two doors, and if I get the first one, that person gets the second one. There's this kind of handing it back to you thing that happens. Pretty awesome. Sometimes it's this full-on, like, look you in the eye thing. Just like, and usually with elderly people, you know. Thank you. Well, now we're going to fill right back up. That was fantastic. You know, they just this connection and a real sense of appreciation. And it's pretty rare, at least in my experience, that somebody just hauls through the door and keeps on going without ever acknowledging it yet.
Well, I just have to tell you, Tim, I'm sorry to interrupt, but
that's all right.
There was a pastor at Pembina, the Fort Garry MB Church, for a while named Danny Unruh.
Yes.
He suffered with depression. And to cure his depression, he would go to the bay and hold the door open for the older ladies who shopped at the bay. And he said that got him through his week, and that was how he dealt with his depression.
Wow.
So it's a well-tested exercise.
I thought it was sort of novel. I'm so pleased to hear that it has a basis in... No, I'm just kidding. It's fantastic. No, it's brilliant.
He actually dealt with his depression that way.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, what a mundane human action. Well, how ordinary is holding a door, right? You know, how many times a day do we get a chance to do something like that? It's been a curious thing to me, and this was in my notes before you told the story you told. You can check with me later. One of the things that has happened in my life as I've started to do this that's been intriguing to me is what is bled into my everyday interactions out of this. And Danny's story doesn't surprise me at all. Because part of what's happened for me is that I've just started to take more time out of those interchanges to interact with the people that I'm interacting with, whether that's the cashier or the server or my kid. You know, you give your kids a chore and there's an expectation that they will do it. It's part of the household way of being. And do they really need thanks? I mean, I'm going to feed them, you know, like... They got a place to sleep. I'm thankful. Whatever. But all I'm trying to say is we can habitually forget to be thankful, just like we can choose to remember. But when I choose to remember in ordinary ways, I find a kind of kindness starts to seep into these other experiences. And I've been so intrigued by how ready people are to open their lives up and talk. And it's been fabulous. Horribly inefficient. Just so you know, if you're going to try this, allot some time. Because every once in a while, you get somebody talking in one of these situations that doesn't really know when to stop, and that's, you know, awkward. It can be fascinating. There might be a lot of ways to understand this, what's going on in a situation like that. I mean, to hear the story that we did about somebody going, I'm struggling with depression, and this is how I'm going to address myself to a certain human and relational aspect of what I'm struggling with, how intriguing. It seems like thanks seems to open something up inside of us. It seems to release something good in us, something good between us, something good among us. Something healing. And I've been thinking about that a lot, and I'm wondering... Does that have a name? Is there a way to talk about that? Is there a way to dig into that deliberately? Or is it just mysterious and we just need to leave it there? I think there are a couple of doorways in to what's going on, what gets released when we are thankful. And I think one way to think about it might be that being thankful and expressing that thanks is an orientation adjuster. It adjusts our perspective on things. I drive into the city, we live outside the city, and I drive in almost every day. It's both a lovely time and something lamentable and necessary. But I take the same route into the city most days. It's sort of the most efficient way in. And last week, Karine and I were coming home from some friend's place, and we ended up, we ended up almost exactly reversing that route. And coming back, do you want to see how many people are looking at you? You don't care a bit, do you? Awesome. We ended up coming back by almost the exact opposite route that we usually go in on. And I thought, well, this is just, you know, you just reverse it, right? This is like mathematically what I'm doing here isn't difficult. There were a couple of corners where I had to actually almost stop and be acutely conscious of which way I needed to turn. And at first, I felt kind of stupid. honestly. It was like, I know where I am. I know where I'm going. I know how this intersection works. And I'm having to kind of go, is there a special license for this age and stage? Like, should I be out here, you know? Because I just felt disoriented by the change in perspective, even though everything around me was familiar. And I think thanks can be like that. When we stop to be consciously thankful, even when we're in a familiar everyday situation, we give our thinking a kind of a shake-up. We start to look at the familiar landscape around us, at the familiar kinds of interactions and events around us in a different way, in a fresh way. The brain science people that I've heard talk about this phenomenon would say that our brains, especially the kind of the frontal lobe parts of our brains that are super active on short-term things, need shortcuts. We've only got so much horsepower to go around. And so one of the ways our brains get the things done that they need to get done is by not bringing to our conscious thought things that our brain knows we know. So we already know this, we don't have to process it, we're just going to do it. Boop, 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 boop. I already know the way into the city, you turn right, then you turn left again, and there we are. All of a sudden when I reverse it, it's like sound of screeching brakes, you know, smoking frontal lobe. That's part of how it works. When we change our perspective on ordinary things, we give our mental processes a shake-up. And we become aware in a different way than we were. I find that interesting, but it still leaves, for me at least, it leaves untouched the question of why it seems to matter to have an object or a receiver for our thanks. Why does it feel unsatisfying to have the feeling of thankfulness without a way of expressing it or without something or someone to express it to? A destination for our thanks. And I think there's, again, lots of ways to kind of come into this, but for me, the way that kind of made sense was to think about common human traits and whether that dilemma might have its roots in some shared human traits. And here's a couple of ways in that worked for me, at least, and maybe they'll prompt other things for us. The first thing that came to mind when I thought about this is that maybe one of the reasons we feel a need to have an object for our thanks is that we are not made to travel through life as an isolated I. Letter I, not eyeball. And we talk about this a lot here, and there's reasons for that. I mean, we just spent most of the fall, you know, nibbling around the edges of quantum physics, and one of the things that quantum science, of course, is telling us is that molecularly we are not an isolated I. We're just not made to process the things in life alone. And we touched on that over and over and over again this morning in community time in a bunch of different ways. We touched on it again when we got into what we're thankful for. We're not made to do this thing alone. We're so not made to do this thing alone that when we're struggling with depression, one symptom of which is often a deep and profound sense of isolation, we might choose to go to the bay and open the door for the elderly folks that are coming in on discount Thursday. And something starts to shift in us. What? Come on. From the vantage point that I think about the nature of God, and that Christendom historically has come at the nature of God, one of the things that deeply informs my imagination about this is the idea of God as Trinitarian. And I realize that that's an idea about God. I also realize that it's an idea that has barely enough foundation in the text of Scripture to survive examination. And yet, there's something so intriguing about it when I come to an idea like this that it stays alive in my imagination. And part of what I find so intriguing about the idea of God as Trinitarian or some idea like that is that God is a communion of persons in that idea. That in the being that we think about and talk about when we use words like God, the idea of relationship is intrinsic. That God relates with God in an unhindered and ideal, perfect, if you will, way. And if we bear in any way through any process in time, the imprint of that sort of a maker, then it shouldn't come as a terrible surprise that when we cut ourselves off from relationship in any part of life that matters to us as humans, we will experience a dearth, we will experience a shortfall, we will experience an incompleteness in that moment that needs redress. It needs us to do something about it, whatever that is. We are not made to be disconnected in that way. This is, by the way, if you're an extrovert, this is not permission for you to judge people who are refueled by being alone. Because being alone and being lonely are not the same thing. And I think we, as humans, we know the distinction. We know how we can need to have time on our own and how some of us are filled up by that. And others of us couldn't stand it for more than 30 seconds. But that in all the way around, any way of assessing personality in this, the one thing that is true is that being alone is not the same as having no relationship to go to, which is to be lonely. We need this. And I think that's one of the reasons, that built-in need for connection is one of the reasons why, as humans, when we come to a thing like thanks, we don't just need to express it, and we find that good, but we need to express it to someone. We need an object. And I use the word object advisedly. I'm not talking about objectified. A target, a go-to for this. It's interesting, you know, when we go looking to fulfill this longing to not be isolated, we tend to look to relationships, we look to friendship and family and love in general, maybe romance in particular, at least on occasion. And we will keep looking in that realm, even if that realm of life complicates our lives immeasurably, which it tends to do. And in fact, we will keep on looking for this kind of connection in despite of all sorts of messes that it gets us into, and we will keep on going with it, or, generally speaking, if we try to step away from seeking connection with other people in relationship, we will deal with despair. We will crash head-on into some version of dissonance that is very, very hard to live with. We're just not made to walk the path of life alone. We want to be, when it comes to thanks, we want to be and we need to be thankful to someone for something. And so, in everyday interactions, we turn to the person that held the door for us and we look them in the eye and we say, thank you. And I think that that whole thing points to an even bigger thing, which is what we are hoping for. The below the waterline, I think, one way to talk about what's going on underneath in us in these things, is that we are hoping that somewhere out there, there is goodness. And we're perfectly willing to start with common decency. But behind all of those social niceties, I think there is a hope that deep within not only the other people that we're interacting with here, but deep within the cosmos, deep within the world that we inhabit and with which we work, there is an unassailable goodness. There is an immutable, a not changeable, a not up to us goodness. And so when somebody holds the door for us, or when we hold the door in our thanks, part of what I think is going on deep inside of us is there's kind of this little thing that kind of is burbling up that's basically saying, I knew it. I knew it. Deep down, people are decent and kind and good, and it's going to be okay. Whatever kind of shit's going on, it's going to be all right, because people are good. See? Right there. That little exchange in my soul. I knew it. And I know that the evening news doesn't necessarily support this view. I know that the pain and the suffering in our own world challenges it deeply. I know that the things we've talked about here this morning challenge that perspective. But I so want to believe it. And when I have an exchange with another human being, in which there is the passing of thanks and the receiving of it, that is just the kind of shred of evidence that I needed to keep me holding on to that possibility. Until some selfish or hyper-focused or otherwise preoccupied person just blows on by that exchange without expressing their thanks. Maybe that dilemma right there is just the kind of conundrum that keeps us from being thankful more often, right? Because anybody who's lived in this, let's just take climate for instance, anybody who's lived any amount of life can tell you that we do this thing as Winnipeggers, people who live in extreme climates, where we kind of say, you know, it sure is nice this month. It's extraordinary. Part B, we're going to pay next month. You just watch, right? Do we not have these conversations? Is it just me? Okay. So that is the weather-oriented version of this bigger thing, where we know, if we've lived at all, that life is a mixed bag. That it's lovely and it's awful. That it's fantastic and it's tragic. That it's beautiful and it's just absolutely unarticulably horrid. And that there's these good bits and these awful bits, and that they kind of come in cycles, but the cycles aren't especially predictable. It's not like you can add up three pains to get one pleasure, you know? Like, it's not like, okay, now it's time. But we still think like that, and we talk about the weather that way, and we talk about our life that way. It's kind of like somebody has 10 bad things happen to them in a row, and you're kind of like, okay, you got your share back at number 3. Like, what's with the continued chain of awfulness here? Isn't it time for the other part of the cycle? So there's something in us that kind of expects this, you know, the scales to balance. And even though we know that it doesn't work like that, but we also know that even if it's not predictable, it's true that it's rarely all one or the other. Right? That it is a mix of the lovely and the not lovely. Now, we can take that reality as our reason to not be thankful, if we choose to. Or we can kind of keep probing our longing for an immutable, unchanging goodness to whom we might express our thanks. When I think about the biblical story, when I think about this library we have, or the unfolding understanding of humans vis-a-vis God, I don't think there's another story that comes to my mind that documents as thoroughly, at least, or as exhaustively, this dilemma as the story of David in the Davidic kingdom. This is a guy, David in particular, this is a guy who gets chapters in the Bible just saying, here's who all his relatives were, just so we can be convinced that he's legit in his lineage. You know, I didn't read it in detail, but I did flip through it to see how many pages it was last week, because it's crazy. So there's this whole point in our library, our spiritual text, that says, pay attention to this story. And so if we keep reading, once we get past all the genealogies, we have the story of this guy's ascendancy to kingship and to power. We have the unfolding of that kingdom becoming more and more powerful and more influential in its realm of the world, and the growth of his family and its ascendancy to power. And then we kind of stay in the story, and the whole thing starts to disintegrate, right? The king living, as powerful people sometimes do, with the sensation that they can do whatever they want, royally screws it up. Sorry, no pun intended. And messes up his life. And his family starts to disintegrate. And we get a story of military coups from inside the family. It turns into the Tudors with... Anyway. And so we get this tale that's in vivid detail, in some cases, but nauseatingly vivid detail at certain turns. That's a mixed bag, right? It's glory and infamy, it's brilliance and folly, it's good news, it's bad news. And mixed in with all of this, one part of the story is the story of one of his kids, Solomon, who becomes the king after David. And it's in Solomon's story that I think we really land on this matter of where to aim our longing for a worthy object of our thankfulness. At least this is what struck me this past week when I was studying this. Books of Chronicles, second book of Chronicles. David always wanted to build a temple, and he didn't get to because he was too busy basically making war either internally or externally. But his son Solomon did get to build this temple, and it's a spectacular project, and it's of some duration, and when it's done, he throws an enormous party, a nationwide kind of party. And it's in 2 Chronicles 5 and sort of following that we have the story of that party. And there's serious praying and speechifying. Solomon goes on at length in his prayer. It's like a political tour de force, among other things. But he just lays it kind of all out in this huge prayer. There's a lot of music making on a spectacular level. Huge choirs, lots of trumpets, lots of woohoo! I want to read you a couple of little bits of this. Listen for the language. Think about what we're talking about. So I won't give you all the text, but these are all from 2 Chronicles, kind of in following one another, not one right after the other. The trumpeters and musicians joined in unison. And by the way, there would have been, by one record, about 120 trumpeters, plus a couple of choirs, loud enough to overwhelm 120 trumpeters. This is a rock show. The trumpeters and musicians joined in unison to give praise and thanks to the Lord. Accompanied by trumpets, cymbals, and other instruments, the singers raised their voices in praise to the Lord and saying, "He is good, his love endures forever." Then the temple of the Lord was filled with the cloud. And so they could see the lasers. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, I'm just pointing out that our way of rocking out is not that new and novel. We're just imitating things. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground and they worshipped and gave thanks to the Lord, saying, "He is good. His love endures forever." The priests took their positions, as did the Levites, with the Lord's musical instruments, which King David had made for praising the Lord and which were used when he gave thanks, saying, "His love endures forever." And it kind of goes on about the details and so on. What, to me, a series of texts like that, in the context of this story, just feel like a profound affirmation of what we're longing for and searching for when we wonder, who can I thank for this? Who do I aim this sensation in me at? This is not a group of people that are saying thanks because all the parts of their story are just humming along. I banged into this theology again last week in a conversation. God help me. I think I was gracious. I just mostly had to get out of the room because I cannot countenance the idea that God is good when everything is working perfectly for us and not good when it's not true. That has just got to be one of the most facile, fragile ideas of goodness ever. What does it depend on? It depends on how I feel about my circumstances. God just shrunk to the size of my lifestyle. This God I don't need. That's a really useless God, man. Because all it takes is one phone call, and God's in the tank. God just got bad, because my life got bad. I'm not talking badass bad. I'm just talking unpleasant bad. These guys in this story have something to celebrate in this moment in their life. And it's a big deal. What they're celebrating is huge. It's worth celebrating. But they are saying, "God, you are a worthy recipient of our thanks because you are good in whatever life brings." What's the refrain all the time? Your love endures. Anybody here who's ever tried to love someone or have someone try to love them over a long time knows that endurance is a not insignificant aspect of a worthy love. Right? Judy, why are you laughing? Never mind. I know why you're laughing. It's not about Bernie. It's just true. Oh, man. So this idea that God's love is an enduring one is a really important idea. Because we're not always so lovable either. Right? And here's the thing. I was talking with a friend of mine on the phone on Friday. He's no longer in occupational ministry, but he was for many years, and we had occasion to be colleagues at one point, and we saw the church do interesting and also nasty things to people, and deep disenfranchisement. We've remained friends. It's been a very fruitful and lovely friendship that continues to this day. It's enduring. It's good. He mentored a couple of young guys as youth pastors, and they went on to other kind of ministerial responsibilities. And last week, two of them basically blew out in 1 week. Failed marriages and church secretaries, and you know, it's just a narrative we're familiar with. I'm not saying their particulars aren't unique, but the themes are not unique. And he phoned me just kind of going, "What the hell?" You know, like he just broke them up.
course it did. So we ended up having this conversation about David, King David, and this story, and David's failure, and how that kind of works, and how do we read this kind of a narrative? How do we understand this? One of the things I said was that part of what's intriguing about Colossians and the people that are celebrating with Solomon saying God is good and his love endures forever, singular, is that in that age, the idea that God might be good even when the crops fail, that God might be good even when the baby dies, that God might be good even when a disease we don't have a name for takes half the village, that idea was a relatively new one, historically, at the point where we're given that text. That's quite a novel understanding of God in a world where there was a plethora of idols, of gods, so that if one of them turned out to be having a pissy day, you could go to one that was doing better and appeal to that one and try to get the crops to grow or the rain to fall or whatever, the baby to start breathing normally again or whatever you needed, you know? The idea that God was one at this point in history was a relatively new idea. The idea that God was good and that that might be an enduring characteristic of God, not a fickle characteristic of God, was new. It was revolutionary because it changed the way we express, among other things, our thanks to God. All the time, not just when things are humming along. And so in the midst of this celebration of something lovely, people are affirming this idea that God is good and that that is an enduring love that does not depend on our circumstance. But sometimes, that's really hard to see. All the time? That's really hard to see. The English poet W.H. Auden talks about this tendency that we have to not be able to see what's going on around us because we're so preoccupied with our own endeavors and our own experiences. He talks about it in a poem, a well-known poem called Musée des Beaux-Arts, which is the name of a museum in which there was a painting by Pieter Bruegel, the elder, a 1500s Dutch painter. And the painting is called Landscape with the Fall of Icarus. So, short art lesson, okay? So this is that painting. And I want to get out of the way here because I want to reference that. Ray, can you see past me? Okay. So this is the painting that Auden writes about in the poem. And one of the things that he says early in the poem, well, a little background first. I mean, the story of Icarus, which Auden's writing about and which Bruegel is painting here, is a story of a mythical son of a brilliant Greek inventor named Daedalus, and Icarus, of course, dies while he's escaping together with his father from this island where they've been held captive. And the way they escape is that his father, in his inventive brilliance, makes a set of wings for them out of wax and feathers, and Icarus gets them on, and it gets such a kick out of the whole thing that he flies too close to the sun, the wax melts, and he falls to his demise. So that's the story. And here's the interesting thing about this painting, is that when you first look at it, it's called The Fall of Icarus, but when you first look at it, unless you're familiar with the painting or you're really being attentive, you don't see Icarus. And until you take the time to look down in the bottom corner of the painting, right there, that'd be Icarus's legs and his feathers flying around. And Auden, writing about the poem, observes that the old masters who painted works like this one were almost never wrong about suffering. And he writes in his poem how well they understood its human position, how it takes place while someone else is eating or opening a window or just walking dully along. This is how suffering happens. And then at the end of the poem he says this. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everyone turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. And the expensive sailing ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. We could spend lots of time in that painting and in that poem. We're not going to. But what I wanted to do is connect it to the idea that taking the time to say thanks, among other things, takes us out of ourselves in ways that can help us pay attention to what's going on around us. And that's one of the great gifts. And when we get taken out of ourselves, when we stop just sailing calmly on, when we choose to put down our plow when we choose to reef our sails, when we choose to step away from the sheep we've been charged to herd, and actually take the time to fish out of the drink the Icaruses of our lives, we are beginning to respond to the world around us in a way that is consistent with the idea that God is good and His love endures forever. One of the curious things, of course, about Icarus is that you could logically say that he made his own mess. He flew too close to the sun, and that's why he's in the bay. That's why he drowns. And you know what? That's often the way this goes. I don't have to think very hard to think about people in my life. I don't have to think very hard about my own story to think. There were times where I needed to get fished out of the bay, but I really deserved to be in there. I did that to myself. Doesn't really matter. It's not our job to decide whether Icarus should be drowning or not. It's our job to step away from the things that occupy us to such a degree that we don't notice Icarus is drowning and to reach out. Thanks, Kim. I think it's the kind of perspective that can only grow in us when we're growing in our own understanding that we have a lot to be thankful for ourselves. Even when our feelings about life or our particular experiences in this moment of life are not dominated by that perspective. Peace.